Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I am Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
This is a repeat of a previous program
that the scientific committee that were responsible for it, who were the top academics in their field in the United States, from neurology to dentistry and toxicology, put together a list of about 70 different areas that they needed studies to be undertaken for in order to fill the gap of lack of knowledge of the effect of fluoride on people's health. I looked at it and I went, what? You must be joking me. This is just ridiculous. And I remember reading one chapter of it, and they had a statement in it, which was their observation with regard to the cytotoxicity of fluoride. And I come from a country that has, for example, many similarities with New Zealand, but we have the unfortunate distinction of having the highest rates of Down syndrome in the world. And they had a statement in it from the experts in the United States saying that it was biologically plausible that fluoride exposure could result in Down syndrome. And I looked at that statement. You must be joking me. They're actually saying there's a biological plausible route of exposure between fluoride intake and Down syndrome, and they're putting it in the water supply.
Welcome to another Green Planet interview. Dentists are taught that fluoridation is an effective practice. However, when dentists investigate for themselves, they find that science disagrees with this theory taught by only a handful of countries. Please note that 97% of European countries do not fluoridate. 10% of England fluoridates, same for Spain. Ireland has 73%. 73% and New Zealand around 50%. How come the Europeans don't want to fluoridate? The day I was contacted to do a radio interview, I was in Munich in Germany. Coincidentally, when I found out, I was with a lecturer in water infrastructure in Bavaria, and he was talking up New Zealand's clean, green image with me. And when I told him that we chlorinate our metropolitan water, as well as actively pursue fluoridation of our water too, he was shocked, because the city of Munich has neither. And then we do find out that 97% of Europe does not have their water sanitized and used as a method of medication. So this has given me plenty of food for thought, or should I say, to soak up. In the studio this morning, I have Professor Paul Connett, Dr. Vivian Howard, and Declan Waugh. And these three men are very learned in their field in relationship to the fluoridation of our world water supplies, and they are here in New Zealand to really help educate the public, because it all comes down to us learning and being open enough in our mind and our heart to just listen to the evidence. So I want to say thank you, gentlemen, for showing up this morning.
Thank you, Tim, for having us.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. Before I start, I want to call out, Green Planet FM has two superb interviews by Lisa Eyre, one of Paul Connett and Bill Hersey of The Dangers of Fluoride, and another one of you, Paul, as well. And I was secretly sitting in the corner listening to that, and it extended me so much as well. So these two interviews give an exceptional understanding of the issues that we have faced in New Zealand as they endeavour to want us to fluoridate across the country. So with that little piece in, I'm just asking one of you kind gentlemen if you could give just a quick appraisal of fluoride, what it is, so that new listeners, because that's what we need. We need new New Zealand listeners to really get on board with this action of taking fluoride out of the water. So would one of you gentlemen kindly offer?
Well, they add fluoride to the drinking water ostensibly to lower tooth decay. Whether or not swallowing fluoride reduces tooth decay is highly debatable. The evidence is weak. But what we're here to talk about is that what we do know is that fluoride is extremely toxic and can damage the brain of the developing child. And the most recent study is a study funded by the US government, by the National Institutes of Health, which looked at 300 mother-child pairs and found a strong relationship between the amount of fluoride that the woman got during pregnancy, as measured at the fluoride levels in her urine, which gives you a measure of total fluoride, and a lowered IQ in their children. And the levels at which they were exposed are the same levels that we are exposed to in fluoridated communities in New Zealand, Ireland, and the United States. This was really the first major study to put the focus on fetal development, exposure to fluoride to the fetus. And that's why the presence of Vivian Howard here, who is an infant and fetal pathologist. He is here to talk about the significance of this. Over to you, Vivian.
Okay, well, when you go to your doctor for a medicine, he knows what size you are, he knows what dose to give you, he gives you instructions about exactly how much to take when. Now, fluoride is administered, I think, as a medical agent for the health of teeth, and it's the only one where we actually don't have any control on how much, what the dose for individuals is. And the thing is that not everybody in the community has the same vulnerabilities to any damage that may occur. So I think the first thing I'd like people to understand is that a fetus is not a young adult. It's very different. And in the case of thyroid hormone, the fetus can't make its own thyroid hormone for the first 12 weeks of life. It's starting to make the gland and it's maturing, but it doesn't actually start to produce it for 12 weeks. So for that period of time, it's entirely dependent on what the mother sends across the placenta. And I'm sure we're going to come to debate the fact that a lot of mothers are actually pretty marginal for their thyroid production. Then the pregnancy itself actually puts a stress on the mother's thyroid gland for a number of reasons. So if they are on the lower side of production of thyroid hormone, then the pregnancy itself will actually further compromise that. We know that fetuses can go on to be born without any thyroid gland at all, because the mother will provide the hormone, and then when they are born, they will have a Guthrie test at 1 week of age to check that their own thyroid is working. So the mother's very important in this particular aspect. Now, there's quite a lot of literature published which shows that if your mother's thyroid contribution during those critical first 12 weeks is low, that's going to cause brain damage. And there's a Professor Pop in the Netherlands, he's published a number of papers, and he's actually shown that in this range we call the euthyroid range, the range of normal distribution of thyroid hormones in the mothers, which conceals some subclinical hypothyroid mothers, between the mothers at the top of that range and the mothers at the bottom of the range, they could detect a difference in IQ of the offspring. So this is clearly a very sensitive mechanism. So the last part of what one needs to consider is, can fluoride in the water affect the mother's ability to produce thyroid? Does it affect? And the answer to that is yes. There are plenty of studies out there showing that. So the paper that Paul has just mentioned, where they've shown fluoride levels, where they've actually measured them in mothers and pair with the child and then followed the child up. Very, very strong longitudinal study design. There is a mechanism for it, and it's well understood. In fact, in the days before some of the drugs used to control the thyroid gland, they used to give fluoride as a treatment for mainly young women in thyrotoxic crisis who could die, and they wanted to control the activity of the thyroid gland to give them enough time to do surgery and remove it. They used fluoride. And so we've known for 100 years or more that fluoride actually suppresses thyroid function. But what we're finding with these later studies is that it's very marginal. It's a very sensitive mechanism, and you don't need to depress the thyroid gland very much to produce this effect that we see in the fetus of reduced intelligence.
So we're delving deeper into complexity, and this really is up to the specialists to be able to then explain it to us, the lay people. So where to next?
Well, maybe Declan, you've seen quite a lot of the studies and you know about them for the reduced iodine in communities and also for subclinical reduced thyroid activity.
Yeah, well, Tim, all I can say really about it to begin with is that it's a rabbit hole and it's a very deep rabbit hole.
I see this very clearly.
As a scientist who specialised in water management myself for many years, it was remarkable that there are none of my colleagues or anyone I know in my profession were ever taught anything about water fluoridation in university. Neither were any of the medical doctors that I know. They know absolutely nothing about fluoridation.
Agreed.
So what got me involved in it a number of years ago was that an engineer approached me one Saturday morning at a food market in the town that I live in, and he said, Declan, will you do me a favour? Like, will you have a look at water fluoridation? Because I'm concerned about its effect on people's health. And I looked at him and I thought, here we go now, here's a conspiracy theorist who's wearing a tinfoil hat telling me that there's something wrong with water fluoridation. And I went home and we were about to have our first child at the time, and I sat down that weekend reading the National Academy of Sciences 2006 report on fluoride in drinking water, which is a huge document. And the more I read it, the more aghast and angry
yes.
and astounded I became at what I was finding out.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was finding out was that they have done literally no studies to look at the long-term effects of fluoride exposure or intake on anything apart from teeth and bones. And that the scientific committee that were responsible for it, who were the top academics in their field in the United States, from neurology to dentistry and toxicology, put together a list of about 70 different areas that they needed studies to be undertaken for in order to fill the gap of lack of knowledge of the effect of fluoride on people's health. I looked at it and I went, what? You must be joking me.
Yes.
This is just ridiculous. And I remember reading one chapter of it and they had a statement in it which was their observation with regard to the cytotoxicity of fluoride. And I come from a country that has, for example, many similarities with New Zealand, but we have the unfortunate distinction of having the highest rates of Down syndrome in the world. And they had a statement in it from the experts in the United States saying that it was biologically plausible that fluoride exposure could result in Down syndrome. And I looked at that statement, and I have it highlighted in my book here, like I brought it with me in case you need it, and I went, you must be bloody joking me. They're actually saying there's a biological plausible route of exposure between fluoride intake and Down syndrome, and they're putting it in the bloody water supply.
I mean,
who would do that?
This is what we're endeavouring to find out.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is that whether or not it contributes to this very unfortunate genetic disorder is another thing, but the fact is that after they reviewed all of the evidence, what they said was that there is a biological plausibility that this could happen. And as far as I'm concerned, you follow the precautionary principle.
That's it.
And if there's a risk, no matter how small the risk, whatever about IQ or anything like that, like in terms of the various other issues that are associated with fluoride, if there's a risk of a serious issue with regards to Down syndrome, absolutely no question whatsoever, as far as I'm concerned, as a reasonable, relatively intelligent individual, would I expose anybody to that risk? And outside of anything else, the issue of IQ that Paul talked about before, the most susceptible and at-risk individuals to loss of IQ are Down syndrome. So if you give a Down syndrome child fluoride, the effect is going to be far more pronounced, I would imagine, than giving it to a child with a healthy IQ. And no one's talking about those issues.
Maybe I can just say something on that. I mean, if you shift the population IQ, this has great big consequences for society. So it's a bell-shaped curve, and if you shift it 5 points to the left, so let's say on average the whole population loses 5 points, you've just halved the number of people with an IQ over 130. Who are the gifted people you need to help run society? And you just more than doubled the number of people with an IQ less than 70. And those are the ones who can't really cope. They have to have support, and so on. For most people, you won't notice it.
Yes.
You know, they can function in life. You'll never know that little Johnny might have been brighter than he actually is, but on a population basis, the consequences for society are big, very big. And I think that's something that has to be considered.
Most definitely, because Paul, you did actually follow this up a lot.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear your latest statement on this.
Well, to say I followed up a lot is an understatement. In actual fact,
your whole life.
The year I got involved at my wife's request in 1996, that coincided with the first two IQ studies on fluoride published in the Western literature. There have been others published in China, but nobody knew about them. So I've been following that since 1996, and we're now up to 52 IQ studies. But this study that I opened with, the Bashash study, this US government funded study, is a watershed moment, because all the other studies have come from India and China and Mexico and Iran, and our arrogant Western scientists
yes.
say you can ignore those people,
yes.
that they're not up to snuff. Actually, China beat us with science over 2,000 years ago. We'll forget that. It was a watershed moment, because all the criticisms that they had leveled about the other 52 studies were essentially addressed. They argued that the Chinese and Indian studies, the water concentrations were much higher than used in water fluoridation. Actually, not quite true, because what you should be comparing is doses, and dose depends how much water you drink, so you can't simply compare communities by concentration. You've got to compare the dose that caused harm with the dose that you're likely to get. But the other thing that they said, oh, they didn't control for this, they didn't control for that, and so on. Now, look at this study, the Bashash study. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health, included the funding by the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Both agencies support fluoridation. It involved researchers from most prestigious universities throughout Canada, the United States, and Mexico, Harvard, Indiana, Montreal, McGill, Harvard, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And between them, the researchers have produced 50 papers on other aspects of neurotoxicity, other elements like lead, mercury, and so on. So top-notch scientists from top-notch institutions. The study wasn't done overnight. It was a 12-year study. It meets all the requirements of a quality study. They controlled for everything. There is not one little chink of light really left for the proponents of fluoridation to continue to deny that fluoride is neurotoxic and has the potential to lower IQ in children. So now the only thing left for the politicians, for the radio broadcasters, yeah. for the general public is to work out what is more important for your child, healthy teeth or a healthy brain. And that's giving them the notion that it actually works to swallow fluoride to reduce tooth decay. It also ignores the fact that if you don't swallow fluoride, you can brush it on your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste. So we're not, by ending water fluoridation in New Zealand, we're not depriving anybody of fluoride. Instead, you apply it more appropriately to the teeth. But really, what Declan's response has been my response for 23 years. How on earth do you have intelligent people in our universities, in our hospitals, and in our governments who are prepared to trade off the future of the children's brain versus some minuscule saving in tooth decay? This is Alice in Wonderland. This play was written by Kafka.
We were all astounded. So we wanted you to jump in as soon as possible. I'm keeping this open for us to get into this flow.
Well, I'll tell you, the study that Paul's talking about there, you've probably had a similar scenario in New Zealand as what we've had in Ireland, because I'm a regular contributor to the print media in Ireland and write letters into all of the newspapers, both regional and national in Ireland, on the issue of fluoridation. I wrote to every radio presenter, every senior journalist, every government elected MP, every editor of every newspaper in the country about that study that Paul just referred to, because it was a huge study. And not a single newspaper or radio station in the whole of the Republic of Ireland actually published any or mentioned anything about that study.
That's powerful, of course. You do that in New Zealand too. This is the challenge that we have got in this country or in the Western world. We're not able to get the information to the people to educate them.
There was one response to the Bashash paper, I think, here in New Zealand, which was to say the fluoride levels in Mexico City are not relevant. That was the only response. They didn't respond to the rest of the science. Well, there was a paper presented in Ottawa last week, which shows that in Canada, the fluoridated levels in fluoridated areas are exactly the same as in Mexico City. Yes. So that removes that argument, and we look forward to them responding to the other aspects of the paper.
Yeah. And the key thing is, Tim, is that because this is a big issue with Ireland and with New Zealand, lesser but still very big. They don't drink tea in Mexico. Mexico has the lowest consumption of tea in the world. And the first two studies that I went and actually published were to do with fluoride levels in tea, because Ireland are the highest consumers of tea in the world. And they've known that tea is a major source of fluoride since 1938. And the very first human biomonitoring study that was ever undertaken on fluoride exposure from tea was published here in New Zealand in 1949 in Dunedin, at a time when there was rationing of tea. And they identified then that tea was the major source of fluoride exposure of the New Zealand population, and they were able to tell that by measuring the fluoride level in their urine after consuming tea. And since that was known since 1949, not a single study was done on measuring fluoride levels in tea in New Zealand until 2016, when myself and a doctor from New Zealand, Mike Godfrey, and two other professors from the United States and Canada published a study on the fluoride levels in tea in New Zealand to show that they are much higher than what they were in 1949. And that, did you know that New Zealand was number three in the world for tea consumption up until the late 1980s, and they're still in the top seven?
Excuse my ignorance, Declan. Are you saying there's fluoride actually in the tea leaves?
In the tea leaves.
Okay.
So, in other words, the last countries that you should fluoridate are countries that are already getting a lot of fluoride from tea drinking. So which would you prefer? Give up your tea or give up your water fluoridation? It seems to me it makes sense to remove water fluoridation. And if Declan is right and that people are getting far too much fluoride from the tea they're drinking, then mix it around a bit. Have tea, coffee, have herbal tea and so on. And look very carefully at the source, the country that's producing the tea leaves, because some countries the fluoride is less, right?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. I mean, the key thing is this: the promoters of water fluoridation in the United States, they left the United States and came to Ireland and said, you've got to fluoridate your water supply in Ireland because we're doing it in the United States and it's a good idea. But they knew in the United States that tea was a source of fluoride. And the Americans themselves said, well, it's not an issue in America because we don't drink tea. But when they came to Ireland, we were number one in the world for drinking tea. We were drinking 10 times the amount of tea as the United States. I mean, the per capita consumption of tea in Ireland was the same as combining the United States, China, Russia, France and Germany together. And we still had higher per capita consumption of tea than all of those nations put together. I mean, it's just... mind-boggling. And New Zealand was the same as Ireland, literally, at that stage. So, like, there was a very interesting study done, the only one in New Zealand that is there to show that there was no effect of fluoridation on children's IQ in New Zealand. And it was done in Dunedin just a few years ago. And they were looking at fluoride exposure in the 1970s among New Zealand kids and whether or not it affected their IQ. And what they were looking at was water fluoridation, like in Dunedin and the outskirts of Dunedin, whether it had an effect. And Paul talks about confounding factors. Like, one thing the proponents of water fluoridation will do is that they'll throw darts at any study that shows a positive association between fluoride and a negative health effect. But if they publish a study that shows there's no effect, they'll never, ever address weaknesses in the study. And that study looked at 1970s fluoride exposure, supposedly an IQ in offspring, and they never addressed tea consumption. And you know how much tea was being imported into New Zealand in the 1970s? 8 million kg a year into New Zealand. You were drinking four times the amount of tea that you are today. And fluoride, since 1949, they knew that tea was the main source of fluoride in New Zealand. But they never looked at the confounding factor of tea consumption when they were looking at maternal exposure to fluoride. So that study is absolutely rubbish.
Yes, well, I'm confounded to the degree that with mums drinking cups of tea when they're pregnant.
Okay, so let's consider that. Certainly, after the child is born, if the mother breastfeeds, there's quite strong evidence that although her blood fluoride level can go up and down as she consumes tea or drinking water, the amount that's going to reach the fetus is low because the breast milk has evolved a system to keep it out. There may be a reason for that. There's a thing called the blood-brain barrier, which forms around the brain, and that doesn't become fully competent or closed until 5 or 6 months after birth, as far as we can ascertain. So that might have developed evolutionarily to keep fluoride away from the baby while that event is happening. As for it travelling across the placenta, well, it does. And we think that, I personally think the major effect here in these IQ studies is probably this indirect action of reduction of thyroid hormone, which is very critical. But there may well be other more direct toxicological mechanisms which haven't been fully ascertained yet. But there is clearly, with breast milk, there's clearly a mechanism to keep fluoride away from the infant.
You know, one of the other strengths of this BASHASH study, and it is the watershed moment again, is the fact that all the other studies are what we call ecological studies. You compare one community with another community. A high fluoride village, low fluoride village. High fluoride in the water, one village, low fluoride of water in the other village. What they do in this study is individualized measurements of the mothers, how much fluoride in their urine, and individualized measurements of the IQ in each child. So you've got a mother-pair relationship, and you simply plot the level of the mother, the level of the fluoride in the mother's urine against the IQ of the children, and you see this relationship. It's very strong, it's very significant, and as I say, if you look at the numbers, the difference in exposure for a pregnant woman between living in a fluoridated community and a non-fluoridated community is about 1 milligram per liter. And that level of exposure in this Mexican City study produced a drop in IQ between 5 and 6 IQ points. And you've heard what Vivian has said. A drop of 5 IQ points would halve the number of very bright geniuses in your society and increase dramatically the number of mentally handicapped. If you know that any substance out there can do it, you have to get rid of it. Look what they did. They took lead out of paint. They took lead out of gasoline. And lead was thought to do exactly that.
That's correct.
Lower the IQ by 5. Now, we don't have to bother the paint industry or the gasoline industry or the petrol industry. We just have to turn the tap off at the waterworks if we had the political will and if we had the testicular fortitude amongst our politicians in Wellington. We're going to Wellington. We've asked to meet with the Ministry of Health and the MPs and the Prime Minister. and who has just had a baby. The Prime Minister of New Zealand has just had a baby. She should listen to us. Would you, Tim, would you broadcast at some later moment whether any of these people deigned to listen to these unwashed experts from Ireland, Northern Ireland and the United States? Did they listen to us? We're not saying agree with us. We are saying open your mind, open your heart to what's going on here, because what we're talking about is the future of children in your beautiful country.
Thank you. I'm in full agreement. I did actually mention it straight after she'd had a baby regarding making sure that she had organic food only, that she put the best of highest quality food into her dear sweet baby. So I did cover that one, and we'll do it again.
Yeah, and I hope you also said to her, if you can do that for your own baby, why not try to do it for the rest of New Zealand's population, especially low-income families? They are the ones who need a better diet.
And they want a high-quality leader who can actually lead.
Yes.
Thank you.
But the issue of odor contaminants is a key issue, Tim, like, because you talked about organic food there, right? I mean, what's astounded me, right, is that every single other chemical toxin that I've looked at, when I've looked at the co-toxicity of fluoride and co-exposure to that other chemical toxin, it results in enhanced synergistic toxicity. So it's a higher level of toxicity, both on the other chemical and on fluoride. So they found that with BPA.
Yes.
They found that with pesticides. They found that with lead. They found that with aluminium. They found that with, say, tobacco smoking, because people who smoke tobacco have higher risks of skeletal fibrosis, because they have tobacco leads to oxidative stress in the body, reduced antioxidants in the body, and fluoride is the same thing. So it compounds it all. So what you're seeing is over the last 3 or 4 decades, as exposures to pesticides increases, and like we're an agricultural community in Ireland, same as New Zealand. There was a report done recently on pesticides in the European Union, and they measured pesticide levels in foods, and they were looking at one in particular.
Glyphosate.
Because it's associated with a whole load of developmental disorders in children, and the highest exposure in the whole European population was Ireland. And there are studies to show that fluoride exposure combined with this pesticide results in enhanced toxicity, and we're the only country that has water fluoridation in Europe. So we have the highest exposure to this pesticide, and we have actually about over 80% of the houses in Ireland now have fluoridated water. So we're getting hit with pesticides, we're getting hit with increased toxicity from pesticides because our water is fluoridated, we're getting hit with increased toxicity from other compounds like BPA because the kids, their immunity system, their immune system is compromised, and very key aspects of the structures of the brain that are associated with modulating the effect of toxicity to pesticides are profoundly damaged because of fluoride in early infancy, and that makes them more susceptible later in life to toxic insults.
I am speaking to Professor Paul Connett from United States of America and Dr. Vivian Howard and Declan Waugh, scientific researcher, who are from Northern Ireland and Ireland, speaking on fluoride. And you can follow this up with fluoride3.org.nz, fluoridefree.org.nz, to connect with some very important information. It's an onslaught, and I know that I haven't mentioned yet, but Coca-Cola is one of the highest industries for sales in supermarkets. Is fluoride in Coca-Cola, in every bottle of Coca-Cola in New Zealand?
Mm-hmm.
It has to be, because I don't think that they're going to source water anywhere else other than the mains. They don't say, oh, mountain spring water with Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is that all these children are drinking all these soda pop drinks, and well, there's fluoride in that as well, and that's not been factored into this conversation, is it?
No, but like, Tim, I tested, apart from teas, right, I tested about 140 different beers for sale in Ireland, right, imported from every country in the world, and I tested two from New Zealand, your Max beer and your Spelt beer, both produced in fluoridated regions of the United States, and they had the highest level of fluoride of any beer in Europe, comparable to Ireland. So the fluoride level was the same as the drinking water supply. So they're using the mains water supply in the breweries in New Zealand. And the fluoride level in the beers in Ireland are way higher than what they would be in Scotland, Wales, or in mainland Europe, in Germany or Poland or any of these regions. They've identified over the last 20 years that Irish beers, both in England and Spain and other countries where they've tested Irish beers that have been exported, have the highest levels of fluoride of any beer products in the world. And there was studies done in the UK and London in 2002 that were referring to excessive fluoride exposure from alcoholic beverages among the adult male population in England, as particularly for those who drink too much, and how fluoride from alcohol was contributing to metabolic bone disorders among the adult population. But that was done by a medical and dental college in London, and when I gave that to the Irish authorities in Ireland, they just didn't respond to it. They don't want to know about it. Like, they didn't want to mention the fact that tea was a source of fluoride in Ireland. They also don't want consumers to know that their beers and their stouts produced in Ireland also contain fluoride. And that's just what you call, like, that's just false indoctrination of the population, feeding them limited, as limiting the amount of information that they can receive in order to keep them ignorant. And that's not acceptable.
A little bit of history here. In Ireland, you had this Fluoridation Forum report, and the Green Party and others organised a parliamentary hearing on that Fluoridation Forum report. And they asked the Food and Safety Authority whether or not mothers should use fluoridated tap water to make up formula. In the original report from FSAI, Food and Safety Authority of Ireland, they said you shouldn't use tap water to make up baby formula because, as Vivian pointed out, the level of in breast milk is very low. If you make up formula with fluoridated water, you're going to give the baby about 200 times more fluoride than nature intended. So the original report from the Food Authority was to the Parliament that you shouldn't use fluoridated tap water. And then that was changed. As soon as they realized that that advice would end fluoridation in Ireland, there was quick phone calls between this group. They made a change the decision by phone. And instead of recommending what I said earlier, they recommended we should encourage women to breastfeed, but without explaining why you encourage women to breastfeed in this context. And John, what is the Green Party? John Gormley said, if that advice had not been changed, it would have ended fluoridation.
Yeah.
So again, it gives you an idea about the politics that operate here.
So you're saying that the Green Party in Ireland are against fluoride?
Well, under the last leader of the Green Party, they were absolutely, totally opposed to it. The Green Party got destroyed in the last general election in Ireland, and one of the reasons was a lot of their supporters got fed up over the fact that they weren't taking issues with regards to water fluoridation seriously. It was on the programme for government when they went into government that they were going to stop fluoridation among the Green Party. And when they got into government, they weren't able to stop it, even though their head of the party was Minister for the Environment. But the way they've organised it in Ireland is that it's the Department of Health responsible for water fluoridation. It's the Department of Environment that are responsible for operating it. And it's the EPA who are responsible for overseeing it. And none of them take responsibility for the whole subject area. So it falls between the stools, and it's just deliberately designed in a way that there's no accountability. And so the current Green Party are kind of sitting on the fence on it. Sinn Féin, one of the largest political parties in Ireland, put in a motion 4 years ago in government to ban water fluoridation and to impose a financial penalty on anybody who would try and fluoridate the water supply against the wishes of the people. And it's astonishing because what you're facing in New Zealand now in the very near future is the scenario that we have in Ireland. In the last 5 or 6 years, every single city council, county council, from local authorities throughout the length and breadth of Ireland, the political representatives have voted to stop water fluoridation. from Dublin City to Cork City to Galway and all of the smaller counties. So the majority of the population have voted through their elected representatives to stop fluoridation. They're saying we don't want it. And the government's response to the elected representatives in a so-called democracy is up yours.
Yes, it is.
Because it's mandatory and you've got to do it either way. Now, you wouldn't find that in a fascist country, even in a former fascist country like Germany. In Germany, where you started today, like, East Germany used to be fluoridated. And the very first thing Germany did when they had unification was to stop fluoridation in East Germany.
Yes.
Very first thing they did.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, as you probably know, the New Zealand government has a bill waiting its second reading that will shift the decision-making from local councils in New Zealand to the district health boards. And the district health boards wait money funded from the government. And so they're going to do what they're told if they want to get plenty of funding. And so this result in mandatory fluoridation, if this comes through, New Zealand is going to be controlled by central government through the district health boards. And this is a huge problem. We've had this with GE that endeavoured to do the same sort of thing.
Yes, Tim, and this is one of the reasons that we are here. It's absolutely urgent that we get this message about fluoride's damaging to the brain and the whole issue of hypothyroidism and so on to the MPs before they make this ridiculous decision to have virtually mandatory fluoridation in New Zealand. That's why we're here.
Yes.
We just hope they will deign to meet with us and listen to us. But we will be having a presentation at Otago University. Hopefully we can reach the professors and the students, and we will then be in Wellington giving another public presentation. But hopefully some of those officials will listen to us too.
Well, Dunedin, in many cases, is the the main habitat for the denial of just wanting to know more. The dental school has had a good name, so to speak, over years. And yet, we're having recalcitrant ideology, in many ways, coming out of there solely because there's more data coming out. And as you say, Paul, you've got this latest information that's hot off the press.
Right.
This needs to be debated, and I think you are Bill Hersey, and you are asking for a fact that if you had two or three pro-fluoride and two or three non-fluoride people having a debate, two-hour debate on public television in New Zealand, on the main, in unison with TV3 and TV1, which are the big stations. This is where the country can become educated. In New Zealand, what's happened is that once upon a time, we used to have only one TV station. And this one TV station used to have all the news. So when you went to work the next day, you'd be able to talk to your next friend and workmates, and you find out that they've listened to the same program. Then you can discuss it. Now, this information is diluted out through these other TV stations too in this country, other than 3-in-1, and people getting information from elsewhere, particularly the World Wide Web. And it's diluting the information that needs to go to the country as a whole. And so everyone's got a little part of everything, and they cannot see the whole picture. And to dilute the consciousness of the people is a way of calling divide and conquer. And this is where we're at the moment.
Well, it really comes down to democracy, doesn't it?
Yes.
Democracy. And in medicine, it comes down to informed consent. Every doctor knows that before you give a treatment, you must tell the patient what the downsides are to the drug, what the benefits are, and then they are meant to choose whether they take the drug or the treatment. And Vivian here is a doctor. He knows that. And what this means, of course, in New Zealand, where you've got fluoridated communities, that local council is doing to everyone what an individual doctor can do, supposed not to do to anyone. And it's a very big thing to lose, isn't it? Informed consent to medication.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I think, I want to say a word or two about the training of doctors, really. In medical school, the amount of training in toxicology is minimal. they do a little bit of metabolism of drugs in pharmacology. But as for environmental toxicology of pollutants and things like that, there's really nothing. Occasionally, I used to run a special module when I was at the University of Liverpool, and that was always sold out. I mean, we got about 30 students on there. It ran for a number of years, but apart from that sort of thing, it's minimal. Now, what sort of skill set do you need to be making decisions about the mass fluoridation of populations with fluoride? Well, I hope I've started to make it clear that you need to know quite a lot about how the fetus deals with particular pollutants, and you need to know what that relationship with the mother is. And we've seen that it's quite complex, and the thyroid gland's definitely involved. So, but the people who are making the decisions, they don't seem to be all that interested in these papers that have come out. Maybe they find them a bit complicated, I don't know. But you need people as part of the decision-making process who are knowledgeable about these aspects of developmental toxicology, and not just about the effect of fluoride on teeth. Because, what Declan's been saying is, this element seems to be able to affect a lot of systems in the body. It's not just affecting the teeth, and that much we do know. So I think a larger element of training, and I hope that, we're going to be talking in Otago tomorrow, I hope that that will stimulate some of the students to start reading a bit more.
Very much so. If it's coming through your urine, it's going passing all the way through the system. We just don't know where these particular particulates are going in our whole body. I mean, recently the European Union tested 41, I think, Green Party MPs from 13 different countries, and every single one had up to three times as much glyphosate in their urine. Mm-hmm. And the Greens would have been drinking the best of water, eating the most organic of food, and yet they were being affected. And this is a time bomb that's moving around people's bodies and then shifting over into succeeding or successive generations when new children are born into the world. We are basically adulterating the DNA over time, and nobody, particularly when you say the precautionary principle, but the thing's mindful anymore.
The things don't actually have to be genotoxic. They don't have to damage the DNA to produce problems. We have about 25 to 30,000 genes in the body. That's been shown. It's about half the number of genes you need to have a wheat plant,
Yes.
And so, for example, the number of connections in the human brain is of the order 10 to the power 15. It's a 1 followed by 15 zeros. It's an awfully big number.
Yes.
So the genes can't specify everything in the body deterministically. There have to be dice involved, the probabilistic elements. And what we do know now is that the environment can interact with genes as they're helping to control development.
Yes, yes.
And produce results. So they can produce permanent deficits. And the concentration of chemicals in general, we've just been talking about glyphosate and pesticides, needed to produce an effect in an adult is 100 to 1,000 times higher than you need to produce an effect in a developing fetus. So these things are controlled in parts per trillion, parts per billion in the fetus, but in general you need parts per thousand, parts per million in the adult. And we know that for many, many compounds. So, this is something which needs to be part of the mix in deciding the regulations for whether you mass medicate a whole population. And just coming back to what I was saying before, there you have to consider the vulnerabilities of different members of the population. So people with impaired kidney function, and there's, lots of those around, they're more vulnerable to the effects of fluoride. Then we have the fetus. It's more vulnerable. All those people need to be protected. And from the results of the Bash Ash paper and other papers that are coming along, it's clear that that isn't the case.
Yes, I was going to say, in terms of what the doctor should know, what anybody at dental or medical school should know about fluoride, number one, nature has never incorporated fluoride in any product, any of the basic biochemistry of the body. Yes, it goes into the bone. Yes, it goes into the teeth. But these are basically topical mechanisms. As far as the mainstream of biochemistry, no use for fluoride, number one. Number two, fluoride is very toxic because it strikes at the very heart of biochemistry. It forms a strong hydrogen bond, and it complexes with metal ions. And that produces a whole plethora of effects throughout biochemistry. It's incredibly complicated. And you don't know this, but I'll tell you, the guy next to you is a genius. I mean, this man, Declan Waugh, over three years, I think, has absorbed more about the literature on fluoride than any other human being on this planet. He's just got a mind like blotting paper. And he's literally set down all the different mechanisms, all the different ways that fluoride can interfere with human biology, human biochemistry. It's mind-boggling.
Thanks very much for that, Paul, but I suppose what I'll have to say is this. No matter what disease I've looked at, from Alzheimer's to Parkinson's to ADHD to autism, or in terms of neurological disorders in kids, to cancer, to anything, the mechanisms by which fluoride interferes with the human body in terms of altering expression of genes and proteins and inflammatory biomarkers is associated with every, and I mean every, inflammatory disease that affects the human species.
Right, okay.
I think I would just like to emphasize the findings of Bashash and other research that's going on, that there's clear evidence now, and I think it's the weight of evidence needs action, that exposure to fluoride in drinking water is associated with damage to fetal brain. Now, I mean, I don't know of a single parent who would trade in a billionth of an IQ point for the occasional need for dental treatment. So, you know, that is the message that we want to get home to people. The research is there. Please read it. Please get your regulators to read it and understand it. And if they need help with that, we'd be very happy to provide it. I mean, it's all out there on the web. That is the crucial matter before us now, and I think it needs decisions.
I've witnessed a lot of mothers, and I've seen how they hold their baby. I've seen how they play with their children. They adore them. So why would a mother who adores her child want to go against common sense and give her baby water that's been sanitized, or in this case, mass medication? I can't work this all out. It defies logic.
But there's a key thing you missed there in that, Tim, and that's this. Why would she want to go against nature? And nature, we've evolved, every species has evolved not to pass fluoride in breast milk to the offspring, right? Every species has evolved that way. It's to protect the developing brain of the offspring that we've evolved that mechanism. And since water fluoridation was introduced and since powdered infant formula became popular, making of powdered infant formula with fluoridated water results in an exposure to infants that is between 20 and 30,000% higher than what is in breast milk. And that is turning evolution on its head. And when that occurred in the 1980s in Ireland and in other countries in the world, we had a sevenfold increase in dental fluorosis, and the rates of ADHD and autism and developmental disorders among children skyrocketed. And people need to think about that, because that's the next round of research that's coming up now. And you're going to see more and more research coming to the fore showing a direct causal association between infant chronic exposure before 6 months of age, along with prenatal and developmental disorders in children. And I'm convinced that research is going to come to the fore very, very soon.
Right, so what are we going to have to do for listeners?
So, well, I think the one thing, while this is all being thrown thrashed out that mothers can do is to breastfeed their child. That's the best protection available.
And also phone the MP, write to the MP. If they can phone, then tell them to listen to us. Just phone your MP and tell them not to let this parliamentary bill go through. It's crazy. At least just put it on hold until these issues have been resolved scientifically. We're convinced, but we need other scientists to be convinced.
I always say, get a delegation involved. Have three or four neighbours. Yeah. Phone your local MP, because local MPs have their offices. One day a month they're usually there. In the previous government, they started to close down these particular meetings because they were getting too much pushback from the citizens. So consequently, the citizens didn't have a say. But this is really important. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to thank you so much for coming to New Zealand and wanting to help us New Zealanders see another way, going back to nature and recognizing that we have to learn, we have to educate, we have to realize that potential within our own being to be able to understand and grow into the light of our own true self.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Vivian Howard, former professor of bioimaging, nanosystems biology, in the Centre for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland, and also Declan Waugh, an environmental scientist and risk management consultant, author of a number of fluoride risk assessments from the Republic of Ireland. And from the USA, Professor Paul Connett, Executive Director of Fluoride Action Network, FAN, and the co-author of The Case Against Fluoride, How Hazardous Waste Ended Up in Our Drinking Water, and the Bad Science and Powerful Politics That Keeps It There. They have been touring New Zealand. For more information, fluoride3.org.nz. fluoridefree.org.nz. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send. And remember, even Facebook. To tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.6 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ra. This was a repeat of a previous program. Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, realize that what you think, feel, and do is part of your unfolding destiny. And when we commit to a higher act of goodwill and or community service, Providence also lines up. So that every conversation we have, every email we send, every phone call we make, and every meeting we attend, that we stand in our power and communicate intelligently, warmly, with integrity, knowing that we are actively shaping a collective future that will benefit all our children and grandchildren, as well as that of a larger community. This is Tim Lynch in Auckland from Nuclear Free New Zealand and mobilizing unity consciousness, wishing you a stupendous week of heartfelt success. I say bye-bye and hari rā.